Good morning. Can everyone hear me okay?
Yes.
Yes.
Morning. I can
Yes.
definitely do it because the last time I was in Colorado,
Yes, I can.
television yesterday's.
Good morning, everybody. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes.
Just one more minute, see if we get
Yes.
one, two. We might have everybody. Bobby, are you ready if we get started?
Yes, I'm ready.
Okay, looks like we have everyone. All right, I'm going to start. I like to call the February 12th, 2026 Pension Committee meeting to order. First item on the agenda is the approval of the November 21st, 2025 minutes. They were sent to you previously. Are there any questions or comments? Okay, hearing none, they will stand approved. Next item is public comment. Ms. Albright, is there anybody online?
There's no one on the line.
Okay, thank you. We'll close the public comment. All right, the next item is the performance reports of the pension OPEB funds, and we have Mr. Wing here to give us those reports. Good morning.
Hey, good morning, Gina. Good morning, everyone. So, as usual, please bear with me for a second as I attempt to share my screen here. Okay, can everybody see that?
Yep, looks good.
Yes.
Thanks.
All right, great. It's a good omen. All right, here we go. So again, good morning, everybody. Let me skip ahead and we'll start where we typically do. Just a few quick comments on the market environment from an economic and market perspective to provide a little context for how and why the two funds performed the way they did during the quarter. So at a high level, from an economic perspective, we talk a little bit about this in the top left bullet point here, noting that the economy likely decelerated in the fourth quarter, according to economists' forecasts. Now, usually we have the data by now, but due to the government shutdown, the BLS is still playing a little bit of a catch-up. And this data usually would have been released at the end of January. It's going to be released a week from tomorrow, Friday. Now, with all that said, the forecast consensus right now is calling for 2.2% growth in Q4, but the shutdown did play a large role. Most economists estimate that that disruption shaved about 1 to 1.5 percentage points off this headline number. So in other words, absent the shutdown, we might have been in the 3.25 to just under 4% range. So it would have been a pretty strong quarter for economic growth on the back of two very strong quarters in Q2 and Q3. Now, importantly, we'll get payback in Q1, meaning that whatever the shutdown shaved off of Q4 will be added back into Q1. So we'll really have to average the two quarters together in order to get a better sense of the underlying economic momentum. But that aside, 2.2% in a vacuum, pretty decent quarter for economic growth given the recent past, and likely would have been much higher absent the shutdown. Now, with all that said, a lot of the drivers that we've discussed over the past, say, 12, 18 months of economic growth and resiliency remain intact and are likely to remain intact over the next few quarters. And we list them here, specifically the capital expenditures in the technology sector on the AI infrastructure build out, reasonably loose fiscal policy and federal government deficits, and somewhat related to that, consumer spending. So I want to touch on each of these quickly to provide a little bit more context why first half of this year, at a minimum, is likely to be pretty solid from an economic perspective. So starting out with the AI infrastructure build out, we're showing some data below here on the bottom chart, hyperscaler capital expenditures. The hyperscalers are basically the five companies listed below here, your Amazons, Metas, Alphabets, Microsoft, Oracle, really spending all the money, the investing in the data center build out. Now, if we look at how the spending has changed over time, I want to start here in 2025, and you can see E on the end of the calendar year here, because it was an estimate at the time we put these data together. We didn't have the Q4 financials yet. After those companies reported, this 498 actually was a little north of, or excuse me, this 398 was a little bit north of 400 billion, came in at about 418 billion, but that wasn't the big story. The big story was their revised guidance for next year, and the spending there has moved from an estimate of about 540 billion to north of $700 billion that they're going to spend next year on this build out. So from an economic perspective, and I'll talk about a market perspective a little later on, the level of dollars isn't necessarily what's important. It's the rate of change. So prior to this revised guidance, you can see it was set to grow 36%, which is an astounding number in and of itself, but much lower than the 68% growth we had last year. Now, given the new estimates, the growth rate's going to be comparable to this. So this should continue to positively impact economic growth with all the spending on the AI infrastructure build out. And as it relates to the other two factors I had mentioned, as far as fiscal policy and consumer spending and how they're interrelated, a lot of it's coming down to the reconciliation bill that was passed last year. So importantly, the provisions in the bill were retroactive to the beginning of 2025, but the IRS didn't necessarily change the withholding table. So in other words, there was more withholding in consumer paychecks than they're ultimately going to owe, which is going to result in higher refunds. And you can see this illustrated a little bit up top here in the average federal tax refund over the past five, six calendar years and how it set the spike this year. So this is just the average refund, may go up by about $1,000, but then in aggregate, there are estimates out there, and we cite one from Goldman Sachs over here, that consumers are going to receive an extra $100 billion, right? So an incremental $100 billion relative to the past 4 or 5 years in tax refunds. And those refunds are probably starting to trickle out now. We'll continue through Q1, head through the beginning of Q2. So that should continue to power consumer spending, which has remained pretty resilient, again, at least through the first half of the year. Now, the one fly in the ointment is probably no surprise to anyone, the labor market right now. We're still getting a lot of conflicting data in the labor market. We talk a lot about that in the middle bullet point, namely that there are some things that look quite positive. You know, the unemployment rate remains quite low. We saw the jobs report come out, I believe it was yesterday, showed a decline in the unemployment rate, showed a decent monthly gain in payrolls, showed a jump in labor force participation. But at the same time, there are other factors, notably, and we show on the chart here, job openings here, the darker line, that have come down notably in the wake of COVID. But more recently, you can see the trend is notably down. And this doesn't include the most recent report that saw another sharp drop in job openings. So you can think about that as essentially labor demand, right? So we're in this almost sort of stasis right now in the labor market, where there's not a lot of hiring going on and not a lot of firing going on. But this stasis has certainly caught the eye of the Fed. As I'm sure you all well know, they continued their rate cut cycle. We talked a little bit about this in November, but ended up cutting rates by a quarter percentage point at their September, November, and December meetings. And as we look ahead here, the market is pricing in about 2 rate cuts this year. The Fed, as its base case released in December, was at 1 cut, but there's some uncertainty around that, certainly how the data are going to play out here. And then we're going to have a new chairman likely in the next 3 to 4 months, and certainly uncertainty around how he may try to shape the committee here moving forward. Certainly a lot of news releases and assumptions around how that may unfold, but we have to remember that the chair is one of 12 votes, okay? So doesn't necessarily mean what the chair is going to do is actually what's going to play out. So a lot of uncertainty around how rates may unfold in the coming months here, which in turn could influence not just fixed income markets, but equity markets as well. But I'll talk more about that a little bit later on after I get to the report and the updates and spend a minute or two talking about the outlook. So with that said, I'll shift gears here to asset class performance. Again, just focusing on the charts to the right here. Again, the green bars are the Q4 numbers, and it was pretty positive across the board, albeit more subdued than we saw in Q3 and Q2. And we can see that in the major equity regions, whether it's U.S., developed non-U.S., or emerging markets. We see U.S. posting a more modest gain of about 2.5%. Developed non-U.S. and EM almost double that, continuing their string of outperformance last year. You can see they returned for the year here in purple, about 14 and 16 plus percentage points more than U.S. equities. It's the first time in quite a while that non-U.S. equities outperformed the U.S. in a calendar year. We look back over the past 10, 15 years, it's been a pretty uninterrupted run of U.S. dominance. As far as fixed income markets, you get to U.S. bonds here up 1.1%. Effectively, what that tells us is that interest rates essentially ended the quarter where they began, because the annual yield on fixed income right now is about 4.5%. So a quarter of that is about 1.1%. So in other words, rate movements didn't really influence returns. This is just the income accrued and received by fixed income holders during the quarter. Now, as far as the other asset classes in the funds, bank loans here, see up 1.2%, modestly ahead of investment grade fixed income. And we would expect that in an environment where equities are doing reasonably well. As we'll see later on, Aristotle, the manager, there was up a little bit closer to 2%, performing quite well on a relative basis. And then speaking of the other asset classes that remain in the funds, we have real estate continues to wind down, and I'll provide an update a little bit later on where we stand there. But that was up a little bit more than 1%. Clarion performing well on a relative basis. And then JP Morgan within the infrastructure was up 3%, also posting a pretty strong absolute and relative return. I want to spend a little bit more time before we get into the funds on the U.S. equity market. As you all know, since U.S. equities comprise about, not quite half of the funds, a little less than that, I always like to see what the themes were during the quarter and how they may have influenced some of the underlying equity investments. And thematically, it was broadly comparable to what we saw in Q2, Q3, namely, even though returns at the index level were more subdued, generally more cyclical, speculative type areas leading the way. And we can see that from a sector perspective, notably which sectors were in the red. There were three: consumer staples, REITs, utilities, generally considered more defensive sectors. And then we can see it a little bit more clearly, I would argue, in the small cap area of the market. We talked a little bit about this last quarter, and it was a similar construct in Q4, specifically that, again, more defensive, conservative, areas of the market underperformed notably. So to illustrate that, on this bottom chart, what we're showing here in purple is essentially the growth of $100 of the Russell 2000, the broad small cap market within the U.S. over time. And you can see it ends at 102.2. So in other words, it had a 2.2% return. But looking at a subset of that market, you can see the Russell 2000 defensive index. So it's companies within this broad market. We'll talk a little bit about what the index is comprised of here. Generally more stable companies, less sensitive to what's going on in the economy, credit markets, and market volatility. They did okay early on, but then underperformed dramatically at the end of the quarter, you can see here. So if you think about it as an accounting identity, if we know what the broad market did, and then we know what the more defensive subset did, then by definition, the more cyclical, speculative stuff outperformed not just the defensive stuff, but also the broad market quite dramatically during the quarter. And again, that's a theme that's been really in play now for the last 9 months or so through the end of the year, really after those April lows, after the tariff announcements were or the April lows were seen about a week later after the tariff announcements. Really speculative run within the market, but particularly within small cap stocks. So with that said, let me jump ahead here and we'll get into the results. Again, we'll spend more time on the pension and then a little less time on the OPEB since the investments mimic each other. But a couple quick comments and then we'll illustrate these in the data. So the market value at the end of the calendar year for the pension was $194.3 million. We saw a net investment change, so that's the appreciation of the underlying assets, just a shade under $4 million. And then a return of 2%, that was modestly behind the policy index of 2.2. So if you recall, when we met in November, providing the October update, I showed the fund was up 0.6% versus 0.9 for the policy. So we were able to recoup a little bit of that. But again, generally headwinds from, as I talked about on that last market environment page, the types of stocks, particularly within U.S. equities, that did quite well. So with that said, and I'll illustrate this in a minute, but digging a little bit more deeply in the difference here, we can talk about attribution, which again, just attempts to explain what drove the difference between the fund and that policy index. So on the positive side, there were some things that were helpful. As I noted earlier, Clarion, JP Morgan, Aristotle, and the real estate infrastructure and bank loan space all performed well on a relative basis. But that was more than offset by a couple things, notably global equity structure. That means generally how we're putting the pieces together, and when we get to the returns, I'll be able to illustrate that more clearly. And then because of some of the more speculative cyclical stuff outperforming, as I noted earlier, underperformance by most of the active equity managers. So they made money, they just didn't keep pace with their broader market benchmarks. And then real estate continues to wind down. And when we get to the update, I'll give you a more up-to-date picture around where that allocation stands. So looking at some of the high-level information, then we'll get a little bit more granular here. Starting with the pension, you can see we began the quarter at just a little north of $190.2 million. Did have a modest positive cash inflow. So when we look at that, coupled with the net investment change, we were higher by a little bit more than $4 million during the quarter. I noted the return quarter to date a minute ago. Fiscal year to date, we're at 7% now. So obviously modestly ahead of the assumed rate of return. We're a little bit further ahead of that now through the end of January, as I'll highlight in a few minutes. So as always, it's nice to be, you know, playing a little bit ahead of the game here, right? If we think about just extrapolating that assumed rate of return over the full fiscal year, we would want to be somewhere in the neighborhood of, you know, 3.8-ish or 3.9-ish% higher through the first half of the fiscal year. And obviously, not only we're higher than that, we're much higher. And I'm sorry, not 3.8, 3.9, 3.33 or 3.4. So in a good spot in the first half of fiscal year 26. And we'll talk more about the returns here in just a minute. Did want to mention quickly, as always, bottom table here, not going to run through all these data, but we see within range and yes, up and down across the board just means that the asset allocation is in compliance with the committee and council approved investment policy statement. On the next page, just quickly, we normally don't hit this page, but worth noting that the fund is at a high watermark. Essentially here at the end of calendar year 2025, you know, the past 5 years, we've seen some ups and downs, most notably calendar year 22, when both equities and fixed income were under a decent bit of pressure. But the past three calendar years have been extremely good, particularly from the equity side of the equation. So we're at this high watermark, despite the fact that over that 5 years, about $7.6 million has come out of the fund for net negative cash flow. Again, you know, Chiron walked through that, those dynamics in November, but largely owed to the fact that the fund is very well funded, and therefore the county contribution, when you're so well funded, isn't terribly high. And as the plan matures, we have more people receiving benefits over time relative to those paying in. As far as an activity perspective, recall this page just lists all the underlying investments, and then I'll just focus on net cash flow here. It's just the activity within the pension itself. And you can see there wasn't a lot. So I noted in November, you know, some comments around maybe doing a little rebalancing as the year progressed, but we ultimately decided to just let things play out a little bit, which in hindsight proved to be the right decision as markets, though a little bit volatile, ended up gaining some decent ground as the calendar year closed. And then as we headed into and through January and the early part of February here. So the big change here is really the money we continue to receive back from Clarion. This is always at the beginning of the quarter, so we just got another chunk back earlier in January too, as that continues to wind down. Now, as far as the returns, just at a high level, as you all well know from a peer perspective, just, you know, looking at how the fund is doing on an anonymized basis compared to other public plans within the third-party performance reporting platform we use. A lot of going on this page. This chart is just an illustration of the data below. And typically, as you know, we just focus on these top two rows. So as we work our way from left to right here, you see that 2% return for the fund was essentially in line with the median within the universe during this quarter, modestly ahead of it on a rounding basis. We're called in parentheses here on the ranks, the universe ranks, where lower numbers are better. So kind of in line, I'd argue, with the median fund of the 500 and almost 70 plans within this universe in Q4. And as we work our way from left to right, kind of a similar story, fiscal year to date, 1 year, where the environment has been very, very strong, particularly for equities, and even over the three-year period, that's still the case. Now, as we work our way from left to right, and we have more ups and downs along the way, as I'm sure you all well know, we've talked about repeatedly over the years, you know, being more conservative and focusing on that downside and trying to participate on that upside. When we have, you know, some ups and downs along the way, generally somewhat of an improved ranking, so kind of oscillating between the top 15% over the five-year and, you know, top third, 3 and 10. Now, what's interesting about that, obviously, these are just from an absolute perspective. When we take into account the volatility profile of the fund on a peer basis, we can view that on this page. So it's a similar construct in their again, peer ranking returns versus public defined benefit plans that I talked about on the last page. The chart on the left are the same exact data. It's just truncated, showing more intermediate and long-term returns. So these are the same data. The key change here is the Sharpe ratio. So this is just a risk-adjusted return. Think about it as, you know, how much are we getting paid for the risks that we're taking? And on a risk-adjusted basis, you can see things look a lot, or very well relative to peers, kind of just around that top decile in the intermediate ones and then top 15-ish percent over the long ones. But what's interesting, if you look at them relative to things on an absolute basis, they're much more improved. And a lot of that comes down to the kind of more conservative positioning within the fund itself that tends to do well when things go wrong. And then over the long term, if you can protect on the downside, you're usually left off in a better place over a full market cycle. So with that said, let me talk a little bit about the underlying investments. We'll hit the OPEB quickly before moving on to the January update. So as far as the breakdown across asset classes here, we see the total fund returns up top, same ones I just referenced earlier on the peer page. And then the total equity composite. So there's a weighted average of US, global, non-US equities, up 2.4%, about 60 basis points behind the benchmark. So if we think about this mathematically, 60% of the fund are equities. So 60% of this, about 36 basis points, is more than this, right? So kind of circling back to my earlier comments about, you know, what was negative from a relative perspective, it was largely the equity bucket, not necessarily the U.S. You can see 2.4% in line with the broad market, largely from the global bucket. And here I'll illustrate my comment earlier around global equity structure. So the three managers here you can see in gray, Dodge & Cox, WCM, MFS, weighted average return of 1.4% behind the broad global equity market, even though two of the three, specifically Dodge & Cox and MFS, were ahead of their respective benchmarks. So if we think about this construct, what we're doing here is essentially we have one value manager, one growth manager. So if we combine their opportunity sets, that's effectively the broad global market. Where the difference comes into play is with MFS. Here is where we're implementing a little bit more of a defensive posture. Again, this fund largely focuses on more conservative companies, more stable companies. So think like stability of profits, less leverage, you know, just more certainty around, you know, where they're gonna end up from a business perspective. So their fishing pond right, or their opportunity set will not include a lot of the speculative stuff that did quite well, as I noted, in the market environment. So when we think about their benchmark or their opportunity set was basically flat, right? So it wasn't necessarily how the managers did themselves. It's the fact that we have one manager that's just structurally more conservative and their opportunity set underperformed the broad global equity market itself. So more of the how we're putting the pieces together to implement a little bit more of a conservative posture was the big drag here. Now, the non-US equity side, not too much to speak of here. You can see, you know, modestly behind the benchmark. A lot of this was due to fair value pricing, specifically that mutual funds, non-US, price themselves a little bit differently than the benchmark. So you can see there that was behind. You know, this is a passive fund, which should be in line with the benchmark over the long term, as you see here. So that can cause some short-term gyrations, but it generally washes out over time. So in other words, we should get a kicker in the positive, or hopefully get a kicker in the positive direction here in Q1. Now, on the positive side, as I noted earlier, some of the other asset classes, whether it be real estate, infrastructure, or our Stato on the bank loan side, all decent returns from an absolute perspective. Clarion, JP Morgan, and again, our Stato all posting pretty strong returns from a relative basis as well. And then finally, within fixed income, not too much of a story here. Note that Wilmington Trust, you know, modestly behind their benchmark, the asset class as a whole, modestly behind. There's also some benchmark mutual fund differences within fixed income that I won't bore you all with here, kind of comparable to non-US equity funds that were at play here. You'll note that this index fund was behind its benchmark due to this pricing. And then when we get to the January update, we'll see how that reversed itself. So that was playing a role here, but you know, more or less in line with the benchmark there. So not too much to speak of within fixed income. And then finally, I will walk through the OPEB at a pretty high level again. I'll skip this because my comments would be the same and we'll look at the numbers here in a second. And then I'll pause before we get in the January update and I have some comments around the outlook as well. So as far as the OPEB, you can see started the quarter at $76.8 million, did have a modest negative cash outflow, but that was more than offset by the net investment change. So all told, the OPEB grew by about, we'll call it, you know, $1.54 million during the quarter. You'll note that the returns here are basically spot on with the pension, as they should be. Again, the investments largely mirror each other. So from a absolute relative basis, whether it be the benchmark, whether it be the peers, you know, the observations and all my commentary from the pension stand. Much like the pension, asset allocation within permissible ranges, so we're in compliance. Like the pension as well, at a high watermark at the end of the calendar year here, despite over the past 5 years, we've had modest cash outflows to the tune of about $2.3 million. So again, you know, 2022 notwithstanding, it's been a pretty strong run for markets over that period, and we're in a good spot from a fiscal year perspective, as I'll highlight in just a second. And then as far as activity is concerned, the themes are the same as the pension, right? You know, not much activity. We let things play out as the market continued to be a little volatile, but gain ground through the end of the quarter into early January. And as we sit here this morning, the one big change, Clarion, again, continue to get money back from there for the pension. Was a little north of 500 grand here for the OPEB, a little more than 200. And again, we got more money back in January. And I'll highlight where that positioning stands here in just a second. But before I get there to the update and make a couple comments around the outlook, let me pause there for a second, see if the committee has any questions or comments before I shift gears.
Does anybody have any questions? Okay, I'm not seeing any.
Okay. All right, we're cruising. Let's see here. Okay. So for January, I'm going to go through the returns and then take a step back, talk a little bit about what we're seeing, what's been going on, and then I'll wrap up with a little bit of a, say, a shorter term and longer term outlook and how we're thinking about things from a very high level. So with that said, let me just make this a little bigger here. There we go. So for January, you can see the pension, again, quarter to date, just encompassing January here, was up 1.7%. modestly ahead of that policy benchmark because the equity bucket, unlike what we saw in Q4 and really Q3 as well, did a little bit better at the margin. So within the market itself in January, I'll get to February in a second, which has been very interesting to put it mildly. In January, what we saw was a broadening out. So in other words, not just the leaders from the mega cap sort of AI related space or some of those speculative cyclical stocks and sort of that smaller mid cap part of the market driving the bulk of the gains. We saw a lot of participation from other parts of the market. And when things are broader, as opposed to being incredibly narrow, like they've been for quite a while now, that's generally a more conducive environment for us, and we can see it play out. So, what drove this modest equity outperformance? A lot of it came from the US here, largely due to this allocation, the Vanguard Small Cap Value Index. You can see small cap stocks did very well in January. So having this allocation with up 5.3% drove things here. On the global equity side of the equation, pretty much in line, and it was somewhat of a comparable dynamic in the sense of, not in the sense that it was in line, but how things played out. Specifically, again, we see two of three managers outperforming their respective benchmarks, but the more conservative one, its opportunity set was about half the broader global equity market, which again isn't surprising given the fact that a 3.3% return for global equities is pretty strong for 1 month. So more defensive, conservative areas in aggregate would lag a little bit. Now, MFS managed to almost double up that benchmark, which was helpful, but a similar dynamic, to the construct I noted in Q4, just not nearly as dramatic. And again, MFS performing very well here, helping at the aggregate level. Non-US equities up 6% in the month. They continue. I noted that 20 minutes ago, maybe now. Their dramatic outperformance in 2025 has continued so far in the 1 month in January, and has actually continued through February here. Real estate infrastructure, we don't have the data yet. Real estate, you'd see down to 1.5%. We continue to get chunks back. Hopeful that, this is wound down by the end of the year. A call from a policy allocation, to where is this money going? One of the two is set to here per the previously approved IPS guidelines, and then the other to fixed income. So that's still going to happen eventually when that's completely wound down. Again, real estate infrastructure don't have the data yet. As far as bank loans are concerned, within fixed income, we did see riskier fixed income, notably lag a little bit. You can see their benchmark was flat, or not flat, excuse me, down modestly during the month. Aristotle, the manager, providing some protection, ending with just a flat return in a difficult month for bank loans. And then fixed income, you can see the reversal I spoke to earlier here, right? So if you recall, in Q4, this passive index fund was 20 basis points behind because of the mechanics of the pricing of the fund versus the benchmark, which reversed itself in January, like I said. And that reversal was helpful at the aggregate level. Now, before I comment on February and the outlook, let me just show you the OPEB. Again, we'll have to get super granular because my comments would be exactly the same, but same returns, fiscal year to date, as I noted earlier, in a great spot, up almost 9% now through January. Markets, despite volatility in February, are higher as well. So as we sit here this morning, we're probably around 10% from a fiscal year perspective. So taking a step back, I'm going to start here with a couple minutes of comments on more of a short-term outlook, and then talk a little bit more about the longer term. But from a short-term perspective, some interesting things going on within the market, to put it mildly. I saw an interesting anecdote a couple of days ago that had mentioned the S&P was basically flat over the previous month, but the average stock within the S&P, right? So the average return of the 500 constituents had an absolute value of 10%, right? So up or down 10% compared to the index itself that was flat. So, I'd say multiples higher than the index, but it can be multiples of zero. But that spread of about 10 percentage points is, borderline historic in the sense that that type of spread has only happened a handful of times over the past 25 years. And what it's really indicative of, and I don't use this word lightly, is it's been violent underneath the surface. There's certain pockets of the market have been just, really just beaten down at times. A lot of it related to concerns around AI and how it may impact various industries, certainly software. More recently this week, there were certain financial services firms that just got beaten down one day. Yesterday, we had real estate services firms coming under a lot of pressure. So certain pockets are experiencing a lot of volatility. So the indices themselves are really masking what's going on underneath the surface itself. And we think about a couple other things that are interesting. I think number one, the range we've been in, at least at the index level, is oddly similar to where we were at this time last year. Namely, we're kind of oscillating around a little bit, kind of unchanged over the past few months. And obviously, there was a catalyst for a decent drawdown given the tariff announcements, and we don't know how that's going to play out. It's just very interesting how we've kind of been range-bound over the past 3-4 months and how eerily similar it was to last year around this time. So that's certainly in the back of our minds. And then the third thing, at least on the short term, is we're starting to enter in a period that over the past 10, 15 years, volatility has tended to pick up a little bit. It's really been around mid-February through the end of March where things have certainly got a little bit more volatile. So with all that in the back of our minds, as I noted earlier, we kind of let things ride and let things play out, which proved to be the right decision in hindsight, right? Obviously, we didn't know it. But with equities continuing to gain ground, that was helpful, not taking any chips off the table. But given the things I mentioned a minute ago, it's likely towards the end of this week or early next week, we're going to rebalance here. Just to give you a sense of that, we ended January. We weren't massively overweight equities, only about a percentage point. Well, we're likely to trim that back down to at least policy levels, maybe even a little bit below, and feed that back into fixed income, where we're basically the mirror image of that overweight in equities. So likely to implement that again either tomorrow or Tuesday, since markets are closed Monday. And the last thing I'll mention as we wrap up more on a longer-term outlook, as you all know, we've kind of been underweight structurally, those large mega-cap AI-related companies for a number of reasons, right? More recently, just for diversification perspective, given they consume so much of the U.S. equity market, if the AI narrative kind of doesn't play out as markets would expect, the U.S. equity market could be more susceptible than it otherwise would have been if AI didn't comprise so much of it. But kind of circle back to one of my initial comments around all that spending from those hyperscalers. What's interesting is if we think about last year, this year, and next year, those five companies in aggregate, it's estimated based on their guidance and analyst estimates, might spend around $2 trillion in aggregate on this build out. So when they're spending all that money, they don't, obviously that doesn't flow into their earnings immediately because these are, assets, right? You think of it as, property, plant, and equipment to some degree. So they're depreciating that spending over the useful lives of those assets, right? And, I'll just want to, a little bit hesitant to talk accounting with the group that's on the call here, but if we think about it, right, if they spend $2 trillion over the next few years and the average useful life of these assets, most of them use is 6 years, at some point in the not too distant future, that means they're going to be depreciating around 300 and whatever, 30 plus billion dollars, right, is going to go to their effect their earnings. And last year, those five companies in aggregate made about $380 billion. So we're coming to a point in not too distant future that if we don't get a massive return on this investment or those companies, that depreciation in and of itself is going to eat into the vast majority of the earnings of these companies due to their legacy businesses. And I think that's what's going on in the market to some degree right now, right? A lot of this increased announced spending, unlike a year ago or 18 months ago, where markets would just celebrate that and their stocks rip higher, there's a lot more discernment around this now where these companies are saying, we're going to spend XYZ which are multiples of the market, and the market's thinking now, well, what's the return of that going to be? Because in a few years, this could seriously impact your financial statements. And even next year alone now, we look at those five names, a couple of them, your Amazons, your Alphabets or Googles, and your Microsofts, Microsoft's the one outlier, your Metas, their CapEx is going to be either equal to or more than their cash flow, right? So their free cash flow is set to go to zero or maybe even dip into negative territory. So what do you do then? You maybe scale back buybacks, or you do what we've been seeing a lot more now, if you go to the debt markets, right? If you don't want to spend all your free cash flow. And Alphabet the other day, and I'll wrap up here, issued about, I think it was $40 to $50 billion in long-term bonds. And they were issued, a part of that issue, there was a tranche in 100-year bonds that were was going to be denominated in UK sterling. So I'm not sure why they chose, that was the currency of choice. Maybe the sterling is going to depreciate pretty dramatically. But we think about these things and how they interact at more of a long-term, or I would say even intermediate, right? 1 to 3 year. It's hard to square all this absent massive return on this investment over the next 1 to 3 years. And then I didn't really even get into the lack of some of the, you know, power on the grid or elsewhere to power these data centers, and other issues around it being approved in local communities, and all those issues aside. I mean, we can even ignore that. And just some of the math just still doesn't quite make sense to us. So long-winded way of saying, you know, those are the things we think about when we continue to maintain exposure, but decent underweights to those areas. Again, in the short term, anything can happen, but over the next 2-3 years, the math itself, again, we just can't get it to make sense to, you know, maintain a market weight in those stocks or even an overweight. So with all that said, I will pause there. Went on a little bit of a rant there, but just some interesting anecdotes that we've been thinking about. But happy to answer any questions or address any comments you all may have.
I have a question related to, interest rates and a new Fed chair, right? So generally, when there's a rate cut and you're forecasting 2 for this year, markets react positively. Is there going to be a difference between a rate cut that's, I'll choose my words carefully here, warranted versus a rate cut that maybe is forced?
So let me answer that too, or let me provide two answers to your question, in the sense of, so I'm going to be clear, you know, we're not forecasting 2 rate cuts. The market is pricing that in, right? So I always mention that because if you think about the yield curve, particularly on the short end, if the market thinks the Fed's going to cut rates 2 times this year, then that expectation is in the 1-year note, right? They're the 1-year bill, the 2-year note. If they don't cut rates, then by definition, those yields will rise, right? Because they're the average expectation of short-term rates over those respective periods. Now, back to your question, we certainly think, let's say the labor market itself in a vacuum is reasonably holding steady like it is now. If we get more cuts than the market is pricing in, the market doesn't think that they're necessarily quote unquote justified, then we may be in an environment where intermediate, or particularly long rates, back up, right? So they don't follow short rates lower, which wouldn't be surprising if I'm reading into your question appropriately. The market is essentially saying these are unnecessary. So if we do get that environment and they're cutting on the short end and intermediate longer term rates are backing up, obviously that would be negative for intermediate and longer term fixed income, and probably in that environment, negative for equities in a vacuum. And, you know, coupled with the fact of equities thinking this could reignite inflation a little bit and higher risk premiums, we would think it could play out like that. Now, importantly, new chairman's 1 of 12, so very interesting to see how this is going to play out. I don't think there's actually been a chair dissent for decades, right? So I wouldn't be surprised if we saw one of those, right? You know, the committee sort of overwhelms the chair, and the chair is one of the dissenters. And if we see that play out, that would be interesting as well, since it hasn't happened for decades.
And is that something that you monitor for?
Oh, absolutely. So what I talked about earlier, you know, potential for rebalancing back into fixed income, I didn't get very granular, but if we think about the construct, and I'm actually still showing fixed income, so this will be helpful to highlight, right? We think about the construct or the pieces within this bucket. We have Wilmington Trust here. They're kind of a, you know, broad fixed income manager. And then we have two other options where we're putting the pieces together, an intermediate 5 to 10 year treasury index, and then a shorter term manager that operates in the 1 to 3 year space. When we rebalance, we're not going to necessarily put much of any in the 5 to 10 because of that uncertainty. We would likely put it in more short-term fixed income because if we get that backing up of rates and, you know, say the 5, 7, 10 year, this will be unaffected because we're only operating in the 1 to 3 year space. So because of everything you just asked about and I commented on, when we do that rebalancing, because of our monitoring and the situation, we're not just going to spread it all out. We'll be more short-term. Right. So we'll be adding fixed income to be a little bit more defensive, but within fixed income, it'll be a little bit more defensive because there won't be as much rate sensitivity.
Thank you.
Of course.
Does anybody else have any questions for Mr. Wing? I'm not seeing any. I just want to tell you, I appreciate the short-term and long-term outlook that you gave us today. You really went in depth there and I do appreciate it. Okay, moving on the agenda is additional business. Does anybody have anything they'd like to bring up? All right, I'm not seeing any. All right, I will accept a motion to adjourn.
So moved.
All right, Mr. Spindell. Second, anybody? Mr. Rogers, second. All in favor, say aye.
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 All right, we are adjourned. Thank you.
Thanks, everybody.
Take care.
See you guys.